thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Acts of Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to the other Scott Horton talk to Scott Horton, and they discuss the European Court of Human Rights condemnation of Bush-era CIA torture practices within the rendition program. They also talk about the U.S. justice system's failure to make the federal government officials accountable for their crimes.
I think the American court decisions look absolutely embarrassing in light of this decision coming out of Europe, because here you've got a European court which deals in a almost surgical, precise way with all the facts, shows that notwithstanding the U.S. government's attempts to enshroud everything in secrecy, nevertheless, even in official documents issued by the U.S. government, there are enough facts that come out to allow conclusions to be drawn. And it points to all sorts of other independent records, which, you know, make these conclusions completely clear. And I think, you know, on the basis of that, you've got to go back and you have to look at the U.S. federal court claims in which they say, no, state secrecy, we can't deal with these matters. And you have to wonder, well, you know, those decisions are clearly not correct. In fact, I'd say those decisions are politically driven. So it's federal judges who don't want to embarrass the federal government in the United States, that do not want to embarrass people who are involved in appointing them to the bench. So it's a failure of independence by the American judiciary.
Now, under your understanding of James Madison's Constitution here, 1789 and all of that, how much immunity are these men actually allowed for what they do? I mean, it seems like they've had 200 years of building on precedents where no judge can, or prosecutor can ever be, or such rare exceptions, but they just are hardly ever held accountable for prosecuting the wrong people, that kind of thing. But that kind of immunity, it seems to have reached just completely ridiculous levels where it's almost like out of the comic section of the newspaper.
I'd say it's absolutely perverse. In fact, I'd say it's particularly perverse against the tradition of Madisonian constitutionalism. In fact, 1793, James Madison made a series of statements in which he said, you know, there is no idea, no notion of immunity. Someone acting under color of the federal government who engages in criminal acts is guilty of the criminal acts. Someone who abuses the rights of a citizen is guilty of abuse of the rights of the citizen. And you cannot claim immunity as a way of shielding yourself for that misconduct. So Madison himself was quite emphatic that there can't be such immunity. And I think it's something that has gone, you know, up and down in American history. So if we look at the 19th century, there were many, many decades in which this notion of immunity built and built and built. It came back down in the early 20th century. Since World War II, however, we have seen a steady process of building immunity doctrines. And in the last 20 years, it's really reached its apogee. So it's you know, largely something that has been done by the heavily Republican judiciary appointed in the period after Richard Nixon. They love the idea of immunity of federal officials. You know, it's not something that has its basis in constitutional doctrine, which, you know, has traditionally held that the government actors are not above the law. They're subject to accountability under the law.
Well, now, sorry to go off on this tangent, but I got to know what you think of it. Did you see the piece in the New York Times about, well, maybe we should just abandon the Constitution anyway? We pretty much already did, and maybe we could have a better system without it.
Well, I don't agree with that. I mean, the Constitution is the bulwark of our law, so, you know, banning it doesn't strike me as a smart idea. But I think, you know, we have reached a point where, you know, it would be sensible to open the Constitution up for, you know, let's say a bit of a recalibration, particularly given judicial constructs that have been put on it that may not be part of the original thinking. I mean, I think if you go back and you look at Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, both of them thought that the Constitution to survive over time cannot be static, that has to constantly grow and change over time through amendments, but also through the process of interpretation.
Yeah. Well, the only worry there is if you ever had another convention, or certainly in this era, it would just be an absolute free-for-all of the...
Well, look what's happened in Congress over the last 72 hours, you know. That certainly doesn't provide someone with assurance that a constitutional convention would be a good thing.
Yeah. I mean... It's funny, the fact that the one that was written by a bunch of slave-owning tyrants is that much more preferable to the next one. It's sort of like in Syria, all these people supporting Assad, because whatever's coming after him is going to be even worse than that, you know?
That's right. And, of course, in Britain, they are perfectly happy with the idea of a constitution that's an airy nothing. It's something that courts construe. But I think Americans feel a little bit skittish about that. And particularly, I think Americans are proud of the tradition of the Bill of Rights. And a clear declaration of the rights of individual citizens.
Yeah, see, that's my thing. I'm all for repealing Article 1, 2, and 3, but I want to keep the... We'll get rid of the Bill of Rights last, you know, and Amendment 13, too. All right, so now, I guess... Oh, I wanted to give you a chance, too, for people to... It's been kind of a while, and I don't know. I sort of fear that maybe people don't care enough, but I was wondering, and you don't have to be too graphic or anything, but could you please tell us a little bit about what happened to this guy, Al-Masri, at the salt pit tortured dungeon in Afghanistan? And you know, could you show... Basically, you know, the face value sort of case for these things are felonies under American law for people who aren't familiar, please.
Yeah, well, the court decision set out the description in tremendous detail. So they say and they describe how he was seized, how he was manacled, put in a diaper, had his clothes cut off. He was gratuitously assaulted and beaten when he was seized. That's for, you know, shock purposes. And then we know he was also subjected to some treatment using psychotropic drugs over a period of many, many months. So it's, you know, physical beatings was one form of torture. Drugs were another aspect of it. And putting him in isolation for an extreme period of time was another aspect of it. He was also... flown in manacles, chained to the bottom of an aircraft in a place that put him under constant stress. So there were many, many different torture techniques that were used. And, you know, I think very, very important, the court case here, I mean, they described what he described had been done to him, but they also pulled out a CIA memorandum that had been submitted to the Justice Department for approval, in which they described this is how we're going to treat people. And they say, well, you know, it's interesting because his treatment matches perfectly the CIA memorandum for the way people will be dealt with in the rendition context, and they ruled that it was torture. There was no beating around the bush. It's not just humiliating treatment. They said it was clear torture.
Okay, and now the Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Dianne Feinstein, has, I guess they voted to adopt but not release a 6,000-page research study by their Intelligence Committee staff. Wow. And it's all about the question of the efficacy of the Bush regime torture program. What do you know about it?
This has been in the making for several years now. It was voted and approved by the committee on a bipartisan vote. And now we have the question of releasing this report. Dianne Feinstein, when she went back to California and talking to her constituency, went out of her way to say repeatedly that this report demonstrates clearly that torture was formal policy of the U.S. government approved and supervised at the highest levels, and that statements to the contrary that were made by government officials were not true. And she says that this report will make all of that completely clear. So we have right now a situation where, the heads and former heads of the intelligence community want to keep all this secret, but there's a quite overwhelming public interest in having it all come out and be published. And the government should declassify and authorize its publication. I'd say that would be, you know, a vital step in establishing the truth about the torture program, also vital in dealing with this question of efficacy, that is, whether the government actually got some benefit from the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. And of course, lately we've had this huge controversy over a Hollywood major motion picture called Zero Dark Thirty. And Feinstein and others on the committee and senior figures at the CIA have harshly condemned this movie, saying that it fictionalizes history by showing that torture led to the seizure, the identification and seizure of Osama bin Laden, which is untrue. And in their defense, the makers of the picture say, well, you know, this isn't a historical account. It is a work of fiction. But, you know, it's fiction that's glorifying effectively torture. At least that's the criticism that's been made of it. But I think getting the report out and all the detailed information it provides out is the vital next step. And on that, we've got Dianne Feinstein pushing for it to come out. She's being supported strongly by Senator McCain and by others in that process. And ultimately, it comes down to Barack Obama and his White House. And will they release this report? Will they allow declassification so the report can come out?
That's really the stumbling block, is whether the White House will allow it.
That's right. And the White House in the past has, they move their lips and say, we want all this to come out, and we believe that people should know. But then they have always, for the last 4 years, they have all consistently deferred to the intelligence community. So the intelligence community objects, they'll side with them. So there's been a lack of matchup between the language of the White House and their action when it comes to declassification.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing about, I worry that, you know, if they do release it, still all the discussion will just be about how well it works or not. And there's got to be a few examples where they learned something important. Obviously not one of these ticking time bomb things. We would already know that story if it had ever happened in human history. But it makes sense to think, as they claim, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said, all right, I've fulfilled my obligation to try to resist you as long as I can, and from now on I'll cooperate. Why not? And of course, he claimed that he was responsible for every bad thing that happened since the end of World War II in his confession, which is kind of hilarious. But, you know, on the other hand, presumably they learned some useful things from him or something like that. So I kind of worry that they could make the case that, yeah, look, in these seven cases, we beat the truth out of a guy and it led to something important, right? Doesn't
well, I
seem
think
that impossible.
I think that's right. I mean, that is a key worry. I mean, as long as you can't allow the debate to focus entirely on efficacy, because, you know, while it seems to be clear that the U.S. didn't gain any dramatic intelligent insight from use of these techniques, it's certainly entirely reasonable to think that at some point these techniques would lead to something positive. And that cannot be accepted as a basis for justifying their continued use in the future. The bottom line is that they are illegal and they're immoral, and those are good reasons not to use them, and not even really to enter into to entertain a serious debate about their use.
Yeah. Well, of course, there's the whole thing, and we've talked about this before, how, you know, after torturing people for all those years, and after, you know, a substantial part of the population, those who side with the Conservative Party most of the time, following the course of defending the program and endorsing it and all that, we kind of really changed who we are. There used to sort of be a thing about how Americans are peace-loving folk, and we only would ever get in a fight if we absolutely had to, and that kind of thing. And after a dozen years of being torturers, sometimes we torture people, I don't know.
Well, that's right. I mean, torture in the end, it's not a left-right issue. It's an abuse of power issue. And if we look historically at, you know, regimes who have used torture, I mean, there are as many left-wing regimes as there are right-wing regimes that have used it. You know, the question is, you know, whether the government has a sense of ethics and moral responsibility and whether it respects the law.
All right, now Obama also is arguing that secrecy should prohibit the federal courts from reviewing his murder of the Awlakis, the father and son in Yemen. Does he have a case for the it's a covert action program and courts can't review that, man?
I think it's a difficult case. Well, I would say, he has a case that, with respect to a pending covert action, the courts can't review and can't inject themselves into it. But when the action has been taken and we're dealing with accountability after the fact and we're dealing with a U.S. citizen, I think that case is a much weaker one. And there should be some room for courts to parse claims that are brought by survivors and deal with them.
Well, now, of course, the father, with the help of the ACLU, did try to enjoin Obama from killing Alaki, I guess the grandfather, right, since the younger one. And the courts refused that. And you're saying they actually had a case to the courts really didn't have any jurisdiction to enjoin Obama from killing him in the first place?
It's not a case of none whatsoever. It's a case of courts being very cautious to tread on an ongoing intelligence operation. And I think when the operation is over, and it's a question of deciding claims after the fact, there may very well be much more willingness on the part of a court to go in and deal with it.
But, I mean, they had announced their intention to kill him, an American
citizen.
That's
right. That's right. And you know, to me, the farce was saying this is a state secret. You can't go in and talk about it. And then giving interviews to the Washington Times saying we're going to go do this. I mean, there's a fundamental contradiction between those two things. If it really is a state secret, you don't go give an interview to the Washington Times about it and beat your breast about how you're going to go kill this guy.
Yeah. Well, and then has there been any leaks or, you know, anonymous claims to the Post or anything about why they killed his 16-year-old boy, too?
You know, from everything I understand, that was a mistake. But it was a mistake that was fueled by misinformation. So they had decided that he wasn't 16 years old, that he was older, in fact. And that's based on their faulty research. But he was not specifically targeted, or at least this is the word that they put out right now. You know, he was collateral damage and an attack that was launched against someone else.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, they kind of have to say that at this point, right?
That's right. And you know, we've seen, you know, the CIA. I mean, one of the most disturbing things that's emerged in the last couple of years is John Brennan making public statements that there have been no innocent deaths, that basically everyone who's been killed is a legitimate, fair target. And that cannot possibly be correct. And it makes you wonder, you know, what analysis they use to decide whether someone is or is not a fair target. So I think that's one of the huge issues hanging over this thing. And I mean, another huge issue is the CIA running this program over a period of several years as opposed to the military, because normally we expect the military to run it.
Right. Well, and I think the answer to that, right, it was Brennan and his 3 or 4 dozen best friends gave that story to the New York Times about, you know, their qualifications are, if we killed you, then you were guilty. Unless someone can come and prove the case after the fact, then maybe we'll acquit you posthumously, which,
yes,
of course, never happened.
You know, as a friend of mine who used to serve in the CIA used to tell me, when they're absolutely positive about something, then they're only wrong half the time.
Right. Yeah, good times if you're a Pakistani kid these days, growing up, living life under drones.
That's right. I mean, I think the question is, would you want those same sorts of evidentiary standards to be applied to someone dropping a bomb from a drone on a bar in Queens, New York? Probably not. Yeah. You probably insist on something a lot more stringent.
Well, people mildly objected when they bombed MOVE in Philadelphia back in 1986 and Waco in 1993. And there's a little bit of pushback from things like that, but actually not so strident as you might hope for.
That's true.
Even when it's here in our country. People are like,
well,
yeah,
this is America,
law and order,
you know,
man.
We regale in the power of bombs and missiles, so.
Amazing.
One
right.
of our national traits.
We got to go. Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you again, Scott.
Hey, great to be with you.
Happy
Take
New
care.
Year.
And have a good new year.
You too. All right, everybody. That is the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer from Harper's, harper's.org, the no-comment blog. You can find him there. And, of course, he's a professor at Columbia, et cetera, et cetera.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. We'll be right back.
Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu all over again. Day by day, I hear the voices rising, starting with a whisper like it did before. Day by day, we count the dead and dying, ship the bodies home while the networks all keeps going. Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Could your eyes believe the writing on the wall? Heard it all before. It's like deja vu all over again. One by one, see the old ghost rising, stumbling across big muddy where the light gets dim. Day after day, another mama's crying. She's lost her precious child to a war that has no end. Did you hear? Did you stop to read the writing at the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've seen this all before? It's like deja vu all over again. It's like deja vu.
Keep your big mouth shut!
We're glad you came, but we have to shout. Adios!
Au revoir!
Fin de semaine!